In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stevens Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today features part one of a special two-part Coolest Conversations. My guest is author and Peabody Award-winning director and producer David Leaf. In 1978, he wrote the seminal Beach Boys biography titled The Beach Boys and the California Myth, which has influenced every major biographer of the band since. Recently, the updated edition of the book has been published, and it chronicles events from the 1980s onward, including Brian Wilson's successful solo career. The book is now titled God Only Knows, The Story of Brian Wilson, The Beach Boys, and the California Myth. We'll start part one in a moment, but first, to set the scene, here are the Beach Boys with some of Heroes and Villains in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
I've been in this town so long that back in the city I've been taken for lost and gone. She's still dancing in the night, unafraid of what it do.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and my guest for our Coolest Conversations is award-winning writer, director, and producer David Leaf. In 1978, he wrote The Beach Boys and the California Myth, the first biography of the Beach Boys that has influenced many of the books about the band that have followed, and to some critics, remains the definitive telling of the band and Brian Wilson's story. In 1985, the book was updated, and again, more recently, updated this past June and retitled God Only Knows, The Story of Brian Wilson, The Beach Boys, and the California Myth. How are you, David?
I'm doing great. Do I call you Mighty or Manfred or Mighty Manfred?
Well, whatever suits you. You can call me any one of those. Okay. Sometimes people call me some other more colorful things, but I prefer any of that. Manfred is fine.
Got it. Great so to be with you.
Well, thank you. You grew up in New Rochelle, New York, right?
I did.
So was there much rock and roll radio played on the radio in your home?
In my home, there was a lot of rock and roll radio, but I had a little transistor radio with an earpiece. So I was the only one hearing it. But I know from the time I was six, I remember going to the record store and buying, I think the Del Vikings Come Go With Me was the first 45 I bought. And every week I saved my pennies and I saved my dimes to get one single a week. That was the goal. And so I love music. Music really, not to be sacrilegious, but it's my religion. It's the thing that makes me feel the most. It's the thing I care the most about.
Do you have any siblings?
I have an older brother and a younger brother.
Okay, so you're the middle baby there. Did your brother have the same passion for music as yourself?
My older brother was passionate about music. He even had a little combo in our basement. He played guitar, and a friend of his brought over a set of Slingerland drums, and they were you know, playing things like Wild Thing. My younger brother's a big music fan, but I would say that you know, my life has been kind of marked by my obsession with music.
Well, your parents must have been pretty tolerant. I mean, if your brother's buddy's bringing over the drums to set up in the basement.
I think they were just living their own life and not paying too much attention during the day to what we were doing. They were off at work, so it was a relatively minor intrusion into the household.
So you're in your early teens. You must have heard the Beach Boys on the radio. What was the first tune that grabbed your attention?
I think the first Beach Boys tune I heard was In My Room. The first one that grabbed my attention, right around the same time as Surfing USA and Surf City. And I just remember hearing Surf City, which wasn't a Beach Boys record, but Brian Wilson had written it,
right,
or co-written it. And when I heard that Two Girls for Every Boy as an 11-year-old, it was like, whoa, I got to go there. The Beach Boys, I was a Beach Boys fan in the 60s, but truly the Beatles were my rock gods. And to this day still are. I mean, there's a lot of artists and groups who I've fallen deeply in love with and, you know, gone and seen concerts, slept out overnight to get tickets for people like Springsteen. But nothing has surpassed, I think, that first rush of Beatlemania and seeing them on the Ed Sullivan Show as an 11-year-old.
So you've got this long time, you know, enjoyment, fascination with the Beatles kind of at number one, and you're familiar with the Beach Boys when they're having hits. And yet, I guess around, there's this article in Rolling Stone about 1971, the Beach Boys, A California Saga. Now that influenced you a lot, right? That affected you, sort of set you on this Beach Boys pursuit, this Beach Boys path or not?
That article really changed my life in so many ways. I was going to school at George Washington in D.C., and my dorm was five blocks from the White House. So I think it was Abby Hoffman who said that it was the most strategically located campus in the country because it was the era of the anti-war demonstrations.
Yeah.
And we were, it's not funny to say, we were getting tear gassed and chased by riot police, whether we liked it or not. And so it was a very contentious time. I was studying journalism, and I had kind of become infatuated with Edward R. Murrow, who I had seen on television as a kid, but didn't quite understand what he had done. Mm-hmm. But then I realized he could write a television story with pictures and change the direction the story would go in, most famously with the anti-communist witch hunter, Joe McCarthy.
McCarthy, yeah.
And so when I read this story about Brian Wilson that you referred to and the Beach Boys and Rolling Stone, it was like, what the heck is going on? And the story was designed to promote a new Beach Boys album called Surf's Up. And the story focused on a song, the title song of the album, coming from this long lost album called Smile that Brian Wilson had abandoned for reasons that to this day remain inconclusive, although in my film Beautiful Dreamer, Brian gave the four answers that he said were the reasons why he shelved it. However, when I read that story and I heard the music, something touched me that this Surf's Up was as great as the article said. And the other song on the album that really got to me was called Till I Die, Brian's solo song. He wrote the words and music about basically him having given up on life. I'm a cork on the ocean floating over the raging sea. And my roommate and I became obsessed with all of this. And we just decided something had to be done. Something was wrong here. And my roommate said, well, why don't you do something about it? And I was like, well, okay, I'm going to move to California and write a book about Brian and become his friend and help him finish Smile. It was as ridiculous as somebody saying, well, I'm the class president here in high school. I'm going to be president of the United States. That's how absurd a notion it was. But 4 years after I said that, I moved to California. 3 years after I moved to California, the book came out. And 33 years after I read that story in Rolling Stone, Brian Wilson Presents Smile became a reality.
We know this is all so incredible. And I... So you make this decision to move to LA and write this book, and in 75, you move out to Los Angeles, But to be clear, there was no publisher asking you to write a book. This is just the life mission, right? This is the focus. And if I remember, you're not in LA very long before you meet Brian Wilson, like on a basketball court.
Well, you know, I was in LA 36 hours when I ran into his brother Dennis on the street.
Yeah.
And I went up to him and introduced myself. And I said, hi, I was never shy. I said, hi, Dennis. My name is David Leaf. I just moved to California to write a book about your brother, Brian. And he just laughed and laughed. And he said, good luck. Because he realized what an impossible thing it was. About 6 months after that, a friend of mine from college and I were shooting hoops at the West Side Y. And two guys walk onto the court. One of them is a just retired NBA player named Stan Love, the brother of Beach Boys lead singer Mike Love. And with him is Brian Wilson. And Stan says to us, you guys want to play 2-on-2? Yeah, we did. Okay. And it's just as surreal a moment as one could imagine that here's this guy who by legend never left his bedroom. And here he is at the gym and we're playing 2-on-2.
Right. And you recognize him?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't say anything like, oh my God, I moved here to California to write a book about you. We just play basketball. We just shoot hoops.
So you didn't say, oh, by the way, I met your brother. Your brother Dennis. No.
I played it. I don't know how I was supposed to play it, but I played it just like we were guys at the Y.
Right. And later on, you must have mentioned to Brian, oh, you may not recall, but you know, we shot hoops before.
Well, you know, I'm over the course of the next year and a half, I met him a couple of other times at Beach Boys events, their 15th anniversary concert at the LA Forum. There was a backstage party after the show that I was at. There was a listening party for an album called Beach Boys Love You in April of 77, where I got to spend a little time with him. But as I began working on the book, the people I interviewed realized what the story I wanted to tell just by the questions I was asking. And they said, well, you really should get to spend some time with Brian, not interview him, because he was a notoriously bad interview subject. Mm-hmm. But they said, just, you know, when he comes over for dinner next time, we'll invite you over and, you can get to spend some time around him. And so there I found myself dinner for four with Brian.
So wait, in 1977, you started this fanzine called Pet Sounds.
Right.
So why did you do that? And how did that lead to you actually writing the book, right? The publisher somehow contacts you. Why did you start the fanzine?
I started the fanzine because after I first discovered the Beach Boys in 71, I went from being a sports fanatic whose goal was to be a sports writer and a sports announcer to being somebody who wanted to write about music. And the first article I wrote about music was about the Beach Boys for my college newspaper. In 76, when I moved to LA, I was selling articles freelance to local newspapers and magazines about music, became the LA correspondent for a San Francisco-based music magazine. And I was thinking, okay, well, how can I pay the bills doing this? And so I thought if I started this fanzine, which I named Pet Sounds after what's arguably, you know, the Beach Boys' greatest album of all time. And it was right at the height of the Beach Boys' resurgence in 76, 77. I thought if I get a few thousand subscribers, this could actually pay the bills. And so I did it and we sent it out and I got about 200 subscribers. But one of them was a girlfriend of Brian's.
Oh.
And she read it and she got in touch with me. Now, the big thing that led to the book was that the Warner Brothers publicity head, a guy named Bob Merlis, got a copy and he said, this is terrific. Can I get 1,000 copies of these? I want to send them out to everybody on my mailing list, which he did. And one of the people on his mailing list was a writer at the Village Voice in New York. A guy named Guy Trubé. I guess I should have asked him if he was a hockey player. It sounds like a hockey player's name. And he wrote an article about this fanzine. He interviewed me, And you know, I was always kind of a smart ass. And he said, how long do you think you can do this? I said, well, you know, I'll do a bunch of issues and then I'll do one on Springsteen, which never happened. Mm-hmm. But a publisher in New York saw the article and they were doing a book on the Beach Boys and they needed a researcher and they hired me to do the research. Or they asked me if I wanted to. And before the book started, the guy who was writing it sold a TV miniseries. So I convinced them to let me write the book.
And you were 25 at the time, or how old?
I was 24.
24.
No, 25. You're right. 25.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty amazing. 25-year-old.
You know, I never thought of it as anything other than what I was supposed to do. It's like, yeah. I've written endless proposals and treatments and scripts for all sorts of projects. And my students at UCLA asked me, so how did you do so much? I said, the question is, how much rejection are you willing to take?
Yeah.
Because, you know, in this business, you know, 99 out of 100 times, your ideas don't go anywhere. And when I wrote this letter to the publisher, it was a 2.5-page letter convincing them as to why I should write the book. They needed a writer. They had a publication date. And I guess the letter was well written enough that they thought I could write a book. Now, I was a guy in college who, if the course required a term paper, I would drop the class. It's like, that's way too much work.
Right. But you had written articles. I mean, you went to journalism school. So, I mean, and you had this incredible motivation. I mean, did you mention in this pitch letter that, you know, you moved to L.A. to write the story of Brian Wilson?
I did. I did. That was the whole pitch. The whole pitch was that I had been inspired by, you know, the Beach Boys and the music and his story to come to California to write a book about him. So the book was going to be about somebody who moved to California to write a book about the Beach Boys. I had no intention of writing the book that I convinced them to let me to write. I just wanted to write a biography of Brian Wilson.
Well, about the book, you know, you detail the birth of the band, chronicle their ups and downs. But more central to that theme is the saga of Brian's struggle, right? Trying to free himself or bring himself into better balance between the needs of his own personal creativity and the responsibilities that he feels or I guess, are imposed on him by the band and others. How did your perceptions of those struggles develop over the years that you've written about?
In between the time that I read that first article in Rolling Stone and when I sold the book, I was obsessed with Brian and the Beach Boys and the music and his story. And I had read everything I could get my hands on that had been published since 1967. There was countless articles. There were radio documentaries. There was all sorts of source material. And the story seemed to be pretty clear that this kid who had been badly abused by his father had a musical gift. And that one day his brother Dennis came home from the beach and said, hey, Brian, why don't you write a song about surfing? All the kids at school are surfing. And that he had with his cousin Mike. And it became a hit within months. Then they got a contract at Capitol Records and there was a series of hits. And then Brian, you know, shelved this legendary album called Smile. And there had been a roller coaster of life in all of those years that was inexplicable. It's one of the reasons I renamed the book God Only Knows. Because very often, if you ask me a question about the Beach Boys or Brian, the answer may well indeed be God only knows. There's just such a mystery to it all. It's so you can't quantify. So how much did drugs impact him? How much did pressure from the record company impact him? How much did intra-group struggles affect him? How much was his ego involved in trying to top the Beatles? All of these things are happening in this shy, sensitive, introverted guy who had been badly abused by his father, who, by the way, got the group their first recording contract, became their publisher and was their manager before they fired him. So there was this wild family story to tell, and I was going to do my best to tell it, keeping in mind that what my main focus, the first line of the book is, this is the story of Brian Wilson. That was always who I wanted to write about. The rest of it didn't interest me that much in terms of the surf culture or actually surf music. I didn't understand what it was like to write a song, to get a record contract, to have a hit, how difficult it was to have more than one hit. All of those things were absolutely areas that I knew nothing about. And many years later, Barry Gibb said to me, when I worked a lot with the Bee Gees, and he said to me, the most difficult thing to do is survive first fame. And the Beach Boys survived first fame, but they were casualties.
So you were touching on, you know, him writing these hits, and I guess focus of the book being writing about Brian. Part of the title, though, too, does conjure up the California myth, the Southern California myth. And you write about him being a victim of that myth. How do you mean that? Is that just related to his having, you know, writing songs that happen to be hits, and then suddenly, you know, the record company, the band, they want to keep him in that mold because that's what's sort of driving the money train?
That's right. He has ears that recognize that music is evolving. So he hears the Beatles going from "I Want to Hold Your Hand" in 2 years to "Rubber Soul." So it's like, well, I have to evolve too. We have to evolve too. And the record company doesn't want them to evolve. They're selling Cheese Whiz, and they don't want to change the formula. There's inside the group, it's like, wait a second, what are these songs? I just wasn't made for these times. That's not me. Hang on to your ego. What are you doing? This is not what the Beach Boys are about. Now, Brian was listening to what the Beatles were doing, and John Lennon was asked in 1966, are you concerned that your new album, referring to Rubber Soul, you'll lose some of your old fans? And he said, yes, but we'll gain some new fans as well. And Brian understood that and believed that. The record company sabotaged the album. But that didn't stop Brian. Because
we're talking about the album, we're talking about Pet Sounds.
Pet Sounds, yes.
Yeah.
When the record stores, in those days, records were shipped to stores and stores sold them. And when they sold out and reordered the album, my understanding is that Capitol Records shipped copies of what was called Best of the Beach Boys, a greatest hits album that had Surfing USA and songs like that on it. And in the record industry, particularly in the 20th century, a greatest hits album was usually a signal that your career was over. And now, in terms of having hits and making records that people wanted to listen to. And so the greatest hits album was, here's how the record company capitalizes on it, no pun intended, one right. last time. I think Capitol Records and their successors have probably released close to 100 greatest hits albums by the Beach Boys through the years. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. About Capitol Records, I guess what kills me about the label is that there could be no luckier label in the history of recording music, since they had both the Beach Boys and the Beatles, and yet they would be exercising all the, you know, sabotaging the Beach Boys' career. It just seems like I just can't fathom why.
These were old people, old not so much chronologically, but they came from the era of big band music and the Great American Songbook. So they understood Frank Sinatra. That's what they understood. They did not understand rock and roll. So when EMI signed the Beatles in England, EMI being Capitol's parent company, Capitol refused to release Beatles records for nearly 2 years.
That's right. Yeah.
So you know, back in the 1990s, when Capitol was doing a book for their 50th anniversary, I was hired to write the chapters on the Beatles and the Beach Boys. And I got to go in the files and see the letters in which Capitol was saying, "No, we don't want She Loves You" or "Please, Please Me." I mean, it was astounding how deaf they were to what was going on.
Despite their best intentions, they wound up making money.
Well, and not only, you know, we talk about sabotage, all the Beatles albums up until Sgt. Pepper had different track listings than the ones the Beatles released in England. And Capitol Records created albums that didn't even exist in England. They created an album called Something New or Yesterday and Today, all designed for the American marketplace. And the Beatles didn't even know about this till they came to America. And they said, what are these albums? Why are you doing this? And they finally got enough power to say, no, it's going to come out exactly as we make it.
Well, let's focus some on Brian's studio abilities. Am I remembering this correctly, that he learned to arrange instruments from a do-it-yourself record?
He did indeed. He as a teenager became obsessed with sound. And his father, for all his father's faults, his father supported Brian's musical search, if you will. He bought him a reel-to-reel tape recorder. Brian got albums like the ones, the do-it-yourself arranging instruments. He also, Brian's father took him to see the Four Freshmen, who Brian was obsessed with. And it was the Four Freshmen's harmony sound that Brian duplicated, imitated, created his own version of with the Beach Boys. And when he combined that with Chuck Berry guitar, as simple as possible, that was the Beach Boys. In terms of the sounds of the orchestra, Brian was never satisfied with a four-piece instrumental group. I mean, as early as 1963, he had a harp on one of their records. So he was interested in new sounds always. He went to a couple of sessions produced by Phil Spector, and he saw what Phil Spector was doing with instruments. As Brian described it, he said, if you had a piano and a guitar play exactly at the same time, exactly the same note, that could create a new sound, a new instrument. So Brian was creating new instruments with musicians, and the Beach Boys were his vocal instruments. As his brother Dennis said in an interview, Brian as the Beach Boys were his messengers.
How much help was Jan Barry in showing Brian Wilson like the ropes of working in a studio? Because Barry was already, go ahead.
Jan was already producing records. I think Brian was a quick study. And, you know, you ask him, and he saw what he needed to see at the Spector sessions. The people who really were most influential and helpful were the session musicians. Hal Blaine, Carol Kay, Glenn Campbell was a session musician.
Right. And I guess contemporary-wise, we refer to those folks now as the Wrecking Crew, right?
Well, they're referred to as the Wrecking Crew today. That was never their name back in the day.
Yeah.
They were just the local AFFM players who were seasoned jazz musicians. And when Brian brought in his songs, they were unlike the other pop songs these musicians were playing on. They were much more sophisticated in their voicings. And so Brian could get from them creativity. There was what they called the snake pit at Motown Records, where these great musicians played on all of the Motown hits in the 60s. And, you know, think about a record like My Girl. Somebody had to play that opening guitar riff. Well, somebody had to play the opening guitar riff on Fun, Fun, Fun. Somebody had to create that. And Brian gave his musicians the space to do that. He inspired them to do that. He would walk into the session. He'd have a chord pattern. He'd sit at the piano. He'd play Hal Blaine, the drummer, the song. He'd talk about the rhythm he'd want for the song. And he was, Brian was a bass player, so he could show the bass player what he had in mind. And it just grew from there. And in a 3-hour session, he would finish a track.
It seems like during the Smile sessions at some point, Brian is actually worrying that becoming paranoid from the pressures and things. But the worry is that Phil Spector is out to get him for surpassing Spector's abilities. And it's kind of weird to me because I think of Phil Spector being kind of a paranoid person as well, perhaps in that same period of time. At what point did Brian feel like he had sort of surpassed Spector and Spector's abilities? Was it around then?
Well, you know, Brian has been obsessed from the day he heard it with the Spector production, Be My Baby by the Ronettes. Yeah. And so I don't know that he ever felt that he surpassed Spector in terms of what Spector did. Spector was, you know, you look up to people and Spector inspired him. But on the charts, he surpassed him with Good Vibrations. Nothing that Spector did, came up to that level of worldwide success. And when Spector had a failure with the River Deep Mountain High, he withdrew.
Yeah,
there was competition on the charts, but there were so many great records coming out of Detroit and Stax and London and L.A. and New York. I mean, there was so much great music that Brian was competing with himself as much as anybody, but definitely with an eye on the Beatles. What are they doing that I have to do? I have to do something that's better than the Beatles. That's really where he was. And there's a great 20-second clip at YouTube where he and Paul back and forth, somebody's edited a piece on them talking about they were in a can you top this situation.
Well, one last thing about the Spector thing, because I thought I was reading somewhere in the book about Brian viewing, you know, his work with harmonies as being something that he could add to that whole sort of Spector sort of production technique, that he could, in that sense, surpass it, or that sense, you know, add something to it that Spector would not have the ability to do.
That's right. I mean, the harmony sound of the Beach Boys records, and Brian was able to actually do it on his solo albums as well, because the studios had gone from 2-track to 3-track to 4-track to 48-track, and Brian could say to the engineer, "Give me 12 tracks." And go out into the studio and sing 4-part harmony by himself on 3 tracks. He would do it for other people's records, Linda Ronstadt, all sorts of, and his solo albums, Van Dyke Parks's record. He could do it. The technology didn't exist back in 64, 65, 66. And there was a certain concern within the Beach Boys that Brian, maybe he was ready to leave them. And in 1966, from Pet Sounds, there were two songs on which Brian sang solo with no background vocals, one of which, Caroline No, came out as a Brian Wilson solo single.
Yeah.
So there was plenty of paranoia. And on Brian's side, I would guess, I wasn't there, it was fueled in part by the drugs that he was taking.
About Pet Sounds, I guess what I find this kind of ironic that he considers Let's Go Away for a While as his most satisfying piece of music. Is that right?
He said that. I mean, one of the things about Brian interviews that you almost have to learn to, I won't say ignore what he says, but take it with a grain of salt. Brian says what he says because that's what he's feeling at that moment when he's asked the question.
Yeah.
And so what I've come to decide is that if he repeats the same thing in a bunch of interviews, then I take it as the gospel according to Brian, because he talks about the opening 16 bars of California Girls as one of his most satisfying pieces of music as well. And he's talked about that repeatedly. Let's Go Away for a While was how he was feeling. And Pet Sounds, I refer to as his emotional autobiography. And he was really struggling to have the freedom to express what he wanted to express, because it was so unusual in popular music to talk about emotions. Dylan had introduced the idea to the charts that you could talk about ideas, that you could make a thinking man's record. But Brian was talking about emotions, how he felt. And Let's Go Away for a While was a record where he captured exactly how he felt at that moment.
And this, his examination of his emotional life in Pet Sounds. I mean, in a sense, this is his first solo album, right? The rest of the band kind of senses that. Yes. and is reactive towards that.
They're not happy.
Yeah.
I mean, Carl and Dennis have expressed through the years how much they loved it. That Brian and Carl used to hold prayer sessions before they did the vocals for Pet Sounds. But when you listen to the record, if you think of it as a Brian Wilson solo album, listen to how many songs he sings lead on. There are two instrumentals and two songs with no backing vocals at all. When I did the Pet Sounds Sessions box set back in 1996, it was clear.
When you say you did the box set, you mean you wrote the liner notes?
I wrote the two books that are in it, and with Brian produced this four CD box set. And when I talked to Brian about my idea for it, which was to have the album in mono and stereo, to have the tracks without vocals, the vocals without tracks, he was like, "People really want to hear that?" I said, "Yeah, Brian, we want to hear that." He was okay. And listening to that, and listening to the session tapes, hearing Brian direct the musicians, you really understood that he was not just the primary force, but almost the only force. I interviewed Chuck Britz, who was the engineer for many of the Beach Boys' greatest hits. And he said to me, unequivocally, now this was a guy who was probably 20 years older than Brian. He was something of a father figure. He said, "As far as I was concerned, Brian was the Beach Boy."
Yeah. Can you explain this notion of Smile not really being an album, but more of a, like an area of creativity, a continuum from Pet Sounds to Good Vibrations to Smile?
So Brian actually wrote Good Vibrations during the Pet Sound sessions. He wrote a set of lyrics with Tony Asher, and then he decided not to include. He said, "I have a different idea for that song." And he spent months in the studio recording pieces of Pet Sounds. It wasn't a traditional song, verse, chorus,
yeah,
bridge, chorus, fade out. It was very different from what he had been doing. And when Good Vibrations was such a success, and everybody was like, "Brian, why is it taking so long? What are you doing?" And it was like, "Relax, everybody." And it's like, "Oh, Brian, the record's too long." It's like, "Relax, everybody. The record's just the right length." And of course, everything proved him right. He decided he wanted to do an entire album in that style, where he recorded pieces of music. So he would write, you know, with Van Dyke Parks, who was his lyrical collaborator on the album, sometimes he would write songs like Surf's Up. Surf's Up is a straightforward song in terms of its structure. But Heroes and Villains has dozens and dozens of pieces of songs that were variations of the theme that he was planning to weave in and out in various places and time, so that the album would have a musical theme, that you wouldn't just go from one song to another. But the idea was a journey, say, from Plymouth Rock to Hawaii. It was an American journey. And you wouldn't necessarily know it from the lyrics, because the lyrics were not easily digested, if you will. It was not, you know, "I love you, you love me," by any stretch of the imagination. And Van Dyke Parks is a brilliant poet, brilliant lyricist, terrific songwriter. He was matching Brian's musical ability with his lyrical ability. Now, here's where it starts to get strange from an outsider's point of view. Brian decides, I want to feel like I'm at the beach when I'm writing these songs. So he has a sandbox put into his living room, and he puts the piano in the sandbox so he can write at the piano with his feet in the sand. Now, people are starting to go, what the heck is he doing? Danny Hutton, Brian's greatest friend, one of the creators of the group Three Dog Night, still on the road with Three Dog Night, said, when you're having hits, things like the sandbox are eccentric. People just say, oh, he's eccentric. When the hits stop, they say, oh, he's crazy. And so during the Smile era, Brian was eccentric because Good Vibrations had become this worldwide number one. He was writing these songs with Van Dyke Parks, and they were amazing songs. Cabin Essence, Wonderful, Surf's Up. Do you, titles like, what are they? What does this mean? Do You Dig Worms? I mean, it's just like, what is this all about? Well, Brian and Van Dyke knew what it was all about. But within the Beach Boys, especially, as I was told by everybody who was there, Mike Love did not like the lyrics. Brian told me that Mike Love did not like the lyrics. Everybody is saying, Brian, this is too advanced for our audience. Mike Love is like, how am I, you know, our audience, when we go out to tour and we play, you know, Do You Want to Dance and California Girls and Help Me Rhonda, how am I going to sing Cabin Essence to this same audience? Well, Brian was not concerned about that. He was only concerned about making a great piece of art.
Right.
So he's
writing the, I wanted to add in here, well, two things before we get further along is we've been talking about Brian's abilities in the studio, and I was not aware of this, perhaps is common knowledge, but I wasn't aware that he's deaf in one ear. So
that's
an extra dimension to all these abilities that which you would think would be a big limitation, doesn't seem to have affected him much at all.
It didn't. The only thing that being deaf in one ear bothers him is that he doesn't get to hear stereo.
Right.
So as he put it, I feel gypped. Here I am, Brian Wilson, and I can't hear stereo.
Well, when you were doing the stereo stuff for like Pet Sounds, and he goes along with that, I mean, who's making the determination about, you know, how things are separated and how things are presented? Did you run past that stuff? And he okays
yes.
it or yeah. Okay.
Mark Lynette engineered it, mixed it. Brian would listen to it. And he would turn his good ear towards the speaker.
Yeah.
And so he couldn't comprehend stereo, but he could hear it. And it's a different sound. It just is, you know, he recorded all his greatest records in stereo. Now they're remixing Giles Martin. Sir George Martin's son is remixing Pet Sounds in what's called an Atmos mix.
What does that mean?
It's some kind of surround sound that they'll put you in the middle of the music. It's just different. Brian didn't need stereo to get across with music. That's how powerful his sounds are.
So back to Smile, and you were talking about the journey from Plymouth Rock out to the West Coast. There's a quote that he has about Smile being a teenage symphony to God. And I think I love that. Can you explain that quote? What is...
It's interesting you ask me about that, Manfred, because when I read that quote, when I put it in the very first edition of my book, I didn't understand it. But when I became friends with Brian, and we became very good friends, and I worked with him on a lot of projects, or we would just hang out and go to the movies, what I came to understand is that he is very, very spiritual. That in a sense, he believes he's almost a channel for God, for the music to come through him to us. So when he talks about a teenage symphony to God, He's talking about this. It's almost like it's an offering that he's here, my Lord, you have given me so much. I'm going to give this to you. It's to you for everything you've given me. And it's, you know, he had a minor hit about 35 years ago called Love and Mercy, the first single from his first solo album. And it's, he talks about what love and mercy is, the difference between them. And he's almost singing to himself, love and mercy is what you need tonight. It's what I need tonight. Because at the time he was in the midst of what he called a 9-year prison sentence when he was under the control of this weird psychologist. Yeah. It didn't stop him from making great music. Nothing stopped him from making great music. Nothing could stop him. It just came literally from his fingers to the piano. Now he's asking himself, where are these melodies coming from? And his conclusion was from a higher power.
And this is interesting too, because, you know, he does these, over the course of his life, he was, you know, I guess there's astrology and numerology and, you know, so he's always got this search for spirituality, but really he finds it, he expresses it and finds it in music and his ability to create music.
I think that's exactly right. And I'll take it another step, Manfred. If music was my religion, the religion I was worshiping was his music. And it's because I believe he had such a difficult life. He had so much pain from the abuse of his father, that his music, even in the early years, had a depth of feeling that's what we as listeners got. Because if you were to take Surfer Girl and In My Room and The Warmth of the Sun and Don't Worry Baby and so many of those beautiful ballads, if you were to strip them of their lyrics and even their vocals, you would feel like you were in church on Sunday and a hymn was being played. Mm-hmm. And in 2021, Brian did a record called At My Piano, in which he did just that. There's just piano-only versions, very soft, prayerful versions of his most famous songs. There's something about the depth of his music that gets through all of the silliness surrounding the image of the Beach Boys. Mm-hmm. It just continues to affect generation after generation. My favorite moment maybe of all of it was on Brian's very first solo tours. We were in Japan, and this very sweet Japanese man who didn't speak very good English, but he said to Brian, "Your music makes my heart soar." Well, I don't know that there's a better description of what Brian's music has done for me and millions of others. His music makes our hearts soar. And you know, a lot of it's just fun. A lot of it's fun, fun, fun. And I get around in California girls. But the reality of it is underneath that is something really deep and meaningful. It's why when I interviewed Paul McCartney and he spoke about God Only Knows, he said, I have to say that may be my favorite song ever, and I can't listen to it without crying. And he and this edition of the book, he opens it with a short overture talking about God Only Knows and the genius of Brian Wilson. And there's something about the life Brian has led that has gifted us with this amazing music. And he's had to suffer for our joy, if you will.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, well, life would still go on, believe me. The world could show nothing to me. so what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
That was a bit of the Beach Boys doing God Only Knows. And with that, we finish off part one of our Coolest Conversations with author David Leaf. Thanks to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast, and join me for part two, where we'll continue our discussion of God Only Knows, the story of Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys, and the California myth on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock, here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.